first meeting of the Veterans and Military Affairs of the 2012 regular session. You notice I did say that, Mr. President, regular session. I voted against it, but we'll come to order. The first item of business is I'll open an organizational meeting. Counselor, if you want to review the committee rules for anybody that hasn't been to a committee meeting yet.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they are the boilerplate model rules, and we've dated them for passage today, if that's what the committee does. And the only item we're making note of to make sure everybody has plenty of notice is the item 14, minority reports are shortened on the deadlines. That's probably the most significant thing about the rules. Otherwise, they're unchanged.
Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Bocas, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 7, 2012.
Senator Monis Anderson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 7, 2012. Any discussion, Madam Vice Chair? Senator Courtney? Senator Olson?
No.
Seeing no discussion, call a roll, please.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Bocas?
Aye. Motion passes. Rules are adopted. Organizational meeting closed. I'm going to, if you look at your schedule, folks, there are four bills, and we're just going to do public hearings right down the entire list and then close the public hearings. If there are any amendments that we're going to put into them, we'll open a work session at that time, put the amendments in, and then we'll be moving the bills next week, those that have consensus. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on...
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Oh, I stand corrected. I'm not going to open a public hearing. I'm going to turn it over to the Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I love reading Voices of the Guard. These are little poems. They're like poems from our National Guardsmen. And it's compiled by Francis Ritchie. But this chapter 7, is talismans. Those are those lucky charms that you sometimes carry around. And one of these is from one of our men or women. I can't tell. It says, in one of the care packages I got from a total stranger, there was this tiny flag folded up in a triangle. Every time I get ready to go out on a convoy, I put that in my left pocket. In another package, there was this little angel. Its gown was camouflage. I still have it. There was a little saying on it about taking care of me when I was driving. I'd hang it in whatever truck I was in. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on SB 1559. Counselor?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1559 has no subsequent referral. It requires multi-line phone systems to provide automated location and callback information when making 911 calls. It exempts systems installed up to 1 year after passage. Defines automatic location identification, automatic number identification, building identifier, callback number, key telephone system, multi-line telephone system, and workspace. Modifies the definition of enhanced 911 telephone service to replace address with geographic location. Yeah. Requires operators of multi-line telephone systems to include building unit identifier and location information. Yeah. Requires key telephone systems and multi-line phones serving less than 10,000 square feet of workspace on one level and one tract to provide only one building unit identifier. Requires manager of multi-line phone systems that require 10-digit dialing to make efforts to ensure users know how to place 911 calls. Requires multi-line phone operators to make arrangements to update database with location and callback number of each phone unit in the multi-line system or otherwise make such information available, and to audit database as soon as practical or within one business day of update and at least annually. Excuse me. Establishes requirements of said update, makes 911 jurisdictions and multi-line phone providers, manufacturers, managers, and operators immune from civil liability for negligent or reckless conduct concerning any multi-line phone system if the system is capable of meeting these requirements, declares an emergency and effective on passage.
Thank you. Senator Olson, you want to address this bill or you want to wait?
I think I'll wait.
Okay. With that, we have five people signed up in the... To be efficient, I'm going to ask Arthur Butler, Larry Hatch, and Mike Dewey to come up, if you would please. And then we'll follow them in the second panel with Daryl Fuller and General Caldwell and anyone else that would like to. And you gentlemen can fight amongst yourself who's going to go first.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Arthur A. Butler. I'm an attorney with Ader Wynn Law Firm. I'm here on behalf of Tracer, which is an organization which represents the interests of large communications users. Tracer believes that Senate Bill 1559 has some significant problems, and we recommend that it not be passed in its current form. Last year, Tracer reached an agreement with the Emergency Management Division representing the 911 community, with representatives of cable and telephone companies, representatives of hospitals and hotels and motels, on a bill that would impose an obligation on end users with multi-line telephone systems to provide information so that the appropriate local PSAP would be able to query the automatic location identification database and get the address and building name for each person calling 911. That bill would also require that the alley database be updated as soon as practicable. That agreement was reflected in the amendments to House Bill 2076-11. Just to clarify, my understanding of that situation is that there were some last-minute tweaks to the language of the bill just before what turned out to be the last hearing on the bill and before it got converted to a funding bill, but that those changes perhaps never made it to legislative council. So the basic thrust of the agreement is most easily obtained by looking at the Dash 10 agreements. We had struggled and still have. I see the same flaws are in 1559 with a shorthand way to describe what end users do when they interact with the 911 system. And I think that that was the thrust of those last minute amendments. It doesn't change the substance. It's just trying to make the language of the bill appear more accurate. The main point I want to make is that that agreed upon bill addresses the biggest problem facing emergency responders, and that is getting to the correct building. Under the present system of 911, what happens is the serving local telephone service provider provides to the alley database the address associated with the termination of their facilities. That is basically the location of the end user's switch. So when a 911 call is placed, what is actually sent to the local PSAP is the address of the switch, not the address of the caller. If the end user has configured its network so that satellite offices, remote locations, are served off the central switch, what will happen is the 911 people will be sent to the location of the switch, not the caller. In other words, they'll go to the wrong building. That agreed-upon bill, House Bill 2076-10 or 11, addressed and solved that problem. Senate Bill 1559, the way we read it, doesn't really address that central problem and instead requires specificity of location identification without really requiring building name or building address, but it goes down to a level of granularity that presents a real problem. At best, with existing systems, it can result in some significant expense and disruption for existing users. At worst, it can require users, particularly of new services, to meet an obligation which they cannot meet through no fault of their own because the technical solutions are not available in the marketplace. Specifically, I refer to voice over internet protocol services and wireless PBX services. Voice over internet protocol services, or VOIP, is basically a calling service which runs as an application over a data network. It generally goes out over broadband connection, not over the traditional telephone network, and it uses the data cabling network on an enterprise's location. It does not use traditional telephone cabling. Our understanding is from an entity which we have consulted, which has deployed VoIP across their entire facilities, taken out their telephone cable and whatever, and did an exhaustive research in the marketplace, is that the best solution available in the market will only allow identification of the location of the local area network or LAN switch, which is a data switch. That LAN switch may be located several floors away from the location of the caller. Callers with VoIP service can hook into any data port or data drop. They can move their phone around because the addressing is in the phone. For example, one organization we know has 7,000 analog telephones, 3,000 digital phones, many of which are VoIP. Those VoIP phones can attach to any of 20,000 data ports in their facility. So the best that can be done is to get the location of the LAN switch, not the location of the caller. With wireless PBX services, which are deployed in order to enable employees to roam freely throughout a hospital or a factory floor or a lab or an office, there is no technology to locate the wireless user of that service. In short, the mandate of Senate Bill 1559 would, in effect, tell Oregon businesses, governmental educational enterprises, they cannot use new services. And those that have deployed new services, change their cabling or whatever, if they have to do an upgrade or change out their system, they're going to have to undo all those changes at considerable expense. We think that this bill crosses an important line. Historically, 911 system developed because someone had the idea that you can provide emergency response by using traditional telephone numbers. Systems that have been deployed in order to meet the end user's primary objectives and their mission. This bill instead says, instead of taking communication systems as they are deployed and used to meet organizations' primary mission, it says, we are going to dictate to you what communication systems you can use, how they're deployed, and how they're managed. That's a bridge too far. We don't think that this is an appropriate requirement at this time. We strongly encourage that this committee amend Senate Bill 1559 to make it more consistent with what was agreed upon with House Bill 2076. We have some other problems with the bill. One is the requirement that changes to the Alley database be made within one business day for existing systems. That's too rigid and too short a time period. It should go back to the standard that was talked about in House Bill 2076 of as soon as practicable. Also, we object to the requirement for an annual audit of the database. That's a huge burden, considerable expense. We don't think that's necessary or appropriate. With my written testimony, I have included some proposed amendments which would make Senate Bill 1559 consistent with what was agreed to in House Bill 2076. And with that, if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
We'll hold questions to the panel. So Mike, go ahead, please.
Thank you, members. Mr. Chair, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. We worked on this legislation last session, and we didn't get as far in the work group as we would have liked to continue the discussion. I've worked with Mr. Butler on this bill and other issues, and he has great expertise in this area. The issue always has been for us is, as we all know, technology is changing, and he did a very good job of explaining some of the technical issues. The companies I represent now provide an array of services to the business community. 10 years ago, if I were before this committee, that would not be the case. So we do provide a technology that is in many ways different than the incumbent telephone companies, although we are all, as we move forward and make investments, investing in the digital world, in the VoIP world. And so he does point out some issues with the bill. Now, I understand that probably this bill could have been a placeholder. And we had started with 2076, and we got up to, I have 10, and I believe, I hate to say this, I had proffered up 11, but I can't find 11. So I'm going to, I think that was a technical amendment to the bill. So what we wanted to do is be sure that we could provide the services to these facilities and meet the kind of the spirit of the law, and also to be sure that at the end of the day, the telecom provider wasn't responsible if, in fact, the business didn't provide the information correctly. So we wanted to make sure that was in the record or at least understood in the bill. So we're willing to move forward with another bill or amendments, but clearly the bill before you is flawed, from our opinion. Thank you.
Mr. Hatch.
Chair Boquist, Larry Hatch, committee members representing Oregon APCO NENA. For the 911 community, we're just trying to get to the point where everyone in the state is supplying the same information to the PSAP so that we can get an emergency responder to the right location of a large facility. A number of
Mr.
times
Chair,
we...
Excuse me?
I don't know what PSAP is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Public Safety Answering Point, 911 Center.
Thank you.
So that we can get somebody into a large facility where the person working out front manning the phone may not even know that a 911 call has been placed. I was a part of the process last year where we did go to Dash 10, and then in Senator Olson's committee worked in there to come up with this is the bill that came out of that group. It needs work, we're willing to do that, but we'd really like to be able to get to the point so that when the dispatcher answers the telephone coming from a large complex, that we're able to know where in that complex the problem exists so we can get the right people there to help them out. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions?
Yes, I have one. Mr. Butler. We've looked everywhere. There is no Dash 11 to be had. And in the work group, we used the Dash 10 as the baseline to put this program together. Were you present at the work group by any chance?
I was invited to the work group. We attended one meeting, but we were never consulted after that.
Were you at the meeting in Bend?
No, we split off and had a separate subcommittee that was to deal with the multi-line telephone system. We had one meeting, which was here in Salem, and as far as I know, no one was ever contacted after that.
Okay.
Right. On the Dash 11, as I explained, I think that what happened there is that the Dash 11 never made it to legislative council. And so all I have is the Dash 10 as well, but there were some, like I say, there were some tweaks that were agreed to just before that last hearing, which you know I referred to as Dash 11, but I, like you, only have the Dash 10 in written form.
Follow up?
Yeah. How do you know? The only thing that concerns me is that, you know, you say it was agreed to, but we had a very large work group of over 70 people each time. No one ever mentioned any agreement to that Dash 11 or even mentioned the Dash 11. And that's the only thing that concerns me is if it was there, we probably should have, you know, had that agreement so we could work. If that would be the new baseline, we should have worked from that instead of this.
Yeah, I think the only change between 10 and 11 was a tweak in how you describe what an end user does when it interfaces with the 911 system. You know, we had language about the the multi-line telephone system user transmitting the location information. Well, it doesn't really do that. What it does is it populates the, or sends information to the automatic location identification database that associates location information with a particular telephone number. It will either be a real number or a substitute or pseudo number. So you, basically the way it works is that the end user has to transmit a 10-digit number with every call that's made, and that number can either be like a DI, direct inward dial number, a real telephone number, or if you can't actually call that number, that station with that telephone number, you come up with a substitute number so that you've associated with it. So when a 911 call is made, it's sent out over a dedicated trunk, either what they call a CAMA trunk or it's a digital trunk like a ISDN primary rate interface trunk to a selective router, which will then recognize those 10-digit numbers and route the call to the appropriate PSAP. The PSAP then uses those telephone numbers to query the database, and the database then shows them the location information. And trying to condense all that down into a few words was a challenge that we weren't really up to. So that's why the continual tweaks.
In, if I may, right, just because I didn't realize there had been a consensus bill, and that's probably my fault. But I think we're trying to do the same thing here in terms of where the problem is and how we solve it. We just thought, working through this for quite some time, that the Dash 10 was getting very, very close to that. And I think the proponents, I mean, their issue is we want to be able to get as close to the location as possible. Again, what we don't want to have to do is have people undo what they've done previously, but I think we can get there. Thank you.
Yes. Well, it's not really a question, I think, and I might be mistaken, but I think one thing that was done in the bill was the building unit identifier. And you had mentioned that we don't know exactly, you know, where this call comes from, but this building unit identifier that was put in there. Are we getting feedback on this thing?
You hear it echoes?
Echoing? Anyhow. That building unit identifier, I think, was a point that we talked about, and we worked on to make certain that it was, we gave the room location, the building that it's in, where it's at, what floor it's on, and all of that stuff. So anyhow, I'm willing to, you know, if the groups want to keep going on this, I'm willing to tack on what we need to do to make it right, because it's better be right before it goes out.
Other questions from the members?
Thank you, gentlemen. Daryl Fuller, General Caldwell. And I would just, for the record, the A10 amendment was discussed on June 1st in this committee last year. So if anybody needs a reference, I believe online there's the committee minutes.
General, I'll let you go first.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department and the Interim Head of the Office of Emergency Management. We support the efforts that have gone forward up to this point on this multi-line telephone system bill. However, I think as the discussion was previously before you, the Dash 10, I think in June, as the good chair has indicated, is probably the closest to consensus that we got. I think there were some technical amendments that the Dash 11 was intended to be, but the Dash 11 actually became a replacement bill, as my recollection was, that it was replaced with another initiative that didn't make it out of the session. So at that late date. So again, I think the efforts of all the groups that have worked so far on this have been great, and I think that people are trying to get to the right point. But probably we need to go back and look at that Dash 10 and refine that real quickly and get it back to you, would be my recommendation. And if you have any questions, I'd be more than willing to attempt to answer them.
Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, members. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Daryl Fuller, on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Prior to the invention of VoIP and cell phones, as a young man growing up in Klamath Falls, I could walk down any city street and a phone booth would ring, and it would be my mom calling to check up on me. So what I think we're trying to do here is just catch up with mom's intuition, because she had an awfully good system of keeping track of my brother and I. And we, as the elected sheriffs in Oregon, want to support any efforts that can move closer to getting us to a position where we know more about who's calling and where they're calling from, because that aids our responders in being able to solve the problems. Now, it's interesting, if any of you guys call me from your offices, it's the same caller ID on my cell phone. If a state office from Portland calls me, it's the same caller ID on my phone for anywhere in the state government. And so you can get a sense of sort of the difficulty that first responders would have with, example, for the state of Oregon, and the 911 system may be better enhanced, that the 911 folks get better information than I do, but the entire state government system is the same phone number as far as my caller ID is concerned. And it seems to me that we've reached a point technologically where some of those issues ought to be able to be resolved, and we're happy to participate and help in any way we can. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Well, just a comment, Mr. Chair. You know, this technology is changing so fast that even if we came up with a bill where things could work now, in 6 months or a year, the technology from our communication system could be changing again. So,
Mr. Chair and Vice Chairman or Chairwoman, agreed. I think that's what the Dash 10 was attempting to do, was get people to the front door of the right building. And then as technology does change, I think you'll probably see advances that will occur probably naturally within the systems. Once the system's set up, it'll be a lot easier for the owner of the system to tweak it and make it work to more specificity. Right now, if we can just get to the right building instead of going to the wrong building, for if you get to the front door, you're a lot better off at the front door than you would be a block away or two blocks away. So, agreed, it's going to continue to migrate forward, and there will be other technological advances. We'll have to deal with it.
Thank you, gentlemen.
We're going to carry, or not carry, this bill is already posted for next week. Its fate yet to be determined. I'd like to confer with the vice chair after the meeting in regard to this, and then I'd ask that General Caldwell and Mr. Dewey, who I'll say is going to be the point of contact in industry, and then Senator Olson and I will get together, and we'll see what the fate is with this. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 1559 and open a public hearing on 1560. Councillor?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1560 requires funds in the emergency communications account. An enhanced 911 subaccount to be used as described in statute declares an emergency effective on passage. This measure has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but we haven't yet requested the fiscal and revenue.
Thank you, Councillor. With that, I'm going to ask General Caldwell, Hasina Squires, and Daryl Fuller to come up. Ladies first.
Thank you, members of the committee, Chair Boquist, and members of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. For the record, Hasina Squires, on behalf of the Special Districts Association and the Oregon APCO-NINA, which is the organization that represents the 911 managers in the state, in support of Senate Bill 1560. You have written testimony before you that outlines our support for the bill. In a nutshell, I feel like this is Groundhog Day number 12. I probably testified on please don't sweep our 911 funds. I don't know how many sessions, I don't know how many times we try to pass a piece of legislation. Each session it is unsuccessful in advancing and usually goes down to Ways and Means to die. So without having a lengthy hearing. We have many things to do today. I'll just reiterate that the 911 tax is a tax that is a 75-cent charge on landline and wireless devices that is collected by the telephone companies out of the good graces of their heart. They remit it to the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue then sends the money to the 911 centers. 60.5% of it goes straight to cities and counties. 35% goes to the enhanced 911 subaccount. Department of Revenue takes a processing fee, and the monies are used are only permitted to be used for 911 emergency services. In the history of the 911 tax, the tax has been diverted a total of 6 times. On page 3 of my testimony, I've outlined when those diversions took place and for what purposes. Out of 6 of those diversions, 3 of them were vetoed twice, 2 different vetoes by Governor Kitzhaber, and also 1 veto by Governor Kulongoski. We support the collection of the tax, the remitting of the tax to the appropriate agencies, and would support any legislation that attempts to advance any type of locking it up in the Constitution, providing some additional protections that you have to have additional votes to not sweep the funds. There are monies that are collected from ratepayers by the companies that are then remitted to local governments, and it's inappropriate to use those for general fund purposes. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. We support the bill, 1560. We support the testimony that you've heard and won't reiterate it. I would suggest that on line 24 of the printed bill, it mentions a 12% below the amount estimated to receive for the biennium. It doesn't say general funds. We assume that that's what it means, but it doesn't say that. So we would recommend that if we're going to have any adjustments to that, that we clarify that to make sure it isn't other funds, federal funds, whatever the case may be. So that would be our only suggestion. Thank you.
Darrell. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. We support the bill as written and would certainly support an amendment if necessary, as General Caldwell indicated. As you likely know, the fee that's collected on your telephone bills that pays for 911 services doesn't even come close to paying for the actual cost of the 911 services for local governments. Those are supplemented by city and county general funds in order to pay the actual cost of 911 services. So the notion of taking the small amount of money we do get from the 911 fee and diverting it to other purposes simply draws funds away from local governments that would otherwise use that money to pay for police officers, firefighters, and deputy sheriffs. And it doesn't make sense to have somebody that can answer the phone instantly if you don't have a deputy that you can dispatch because of the call, because you don't have enough deputies. So we would encourage you to support the bill and appreciate you holding the hearing. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee members?
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Second panel is Scott Winkles, Paul Snyder, and Mary. Ladies first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here this morning representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We represent a number of the 911 centers around the state, and we just want to add our voice to the choir in saying this is a great bill. Don't sweep the money. I was involved in the initial legislation that established the 911 surcharge. I think it's a great idea, and we need to spend that money appropriately. Thank you.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I am representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in support of this legislation. We do support this bill. We weighed in previous sessions and have vociferously argued against previous sweeps. I feel I'd be remiss if I did not point out that the FCC does an annual survey of jurisdictions around the country to determine if they have swept their 911 funds or used those for a purpose other than the receiving emergency service calls. They have done the survey for the last 3 years. Oregon has gone 3 for 3 having swept those funds as a result. And the manner in which these funds are swept, particularly the interest, we're not eligible for federal FCC 911 grants. That is a hindrance to our state. In addition, last year, key members of Congress, members of ranking members and chairs on committees of jurisdiction have inquired on the FCC as to whether or not that they could use their truth in billing authority to take action against jurisdictions that have swept 911 funds. It appears at this time the state of law does not allow that, but the FCC did recently issue a request for comments from a select group of stakeholders asking for ways to improve the transparency and accountability in the use of these 911 funds. And that is my testimony, and I'm eager for questions.
Paul, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we also support this bill. The tax is created for, intended for, the purposes of 911. And the bill, I would point out the obvious, that the bill provides for extraordinary circumstances to be used to provide for a diversion of those funds, but they have to be extraordinary circumstances, and they're prospective only. In other words, the way I read the bill, it's for revenues that are raised after the bill has been enacted, and so we think this is an appropriate response to the situation.
Thank you. Questions to the panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I was wondering, I can't find my SMS, but I was wondering if the Dash 1 amendment was included.
Mm-mm. Do you have a copy of the Dash 1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wilson, no. It's not been released to the committee.
It's not been released to the committee?
Okay.
Do you have a copy of it?
I do have a copy of it.
We'll make sure the committee members get a copy of it. Okay. Other questions?
Just a comment.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm not really, I'm not on the full Ways and Means. And balancing the budget is evidently extremely complex. And if one thing isn't, I'm not justifying the sweeps. I'm not doing that. But I keep thinking that one piece that's not funded in the end sort of hurts 911, just because if we aren't having enough money to go to the cities or the schools, etc. I'm not sure I'm explaining it very well, but there's a ripple effect, and so I can see sweeping funds, but because if we can't balance our budget, there's going to be some pieces of our budget that are not going to be funded, and therefore business as usual in the state of Oregon won't be able to happen. So I know it's a stretch, but until we're able to come up, if you could come up with other ways to get revenue into the state. We are cutting, we are becoming more efficient, we are having audits, we're doing a lot, but this is a very, very complex issue.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, please.
If I may. It's kind of interesting in getting into this and being on this end of the dais, and was asked to do this work group. And one learns quite quickly how important 911 is. And Senator Mona Sanderson, to your concerns, if you're on the highway out in the remote area of Oregon and you have a car accident
and you dial 911 and you expect someone to come, sometimes it's difficult. And it's difficult because we are not able to upgrade our equipment, and the reason we are not able to upgrade that equipment is because the funds have been swept. And unfortunately, in this economic times, money is short. But in this case, when this money is collected and put together, it's put together for a specific purpose, and that purpose is to be able to maintain and upgrade 911. And if we do not use that money to maintain and upgrade 911, what happens is we fall back precipitously. And as was said earlier in the bill prior to this, 1559, technology changes quickly and greatly. And if we keep sweeping this money, or if we do take this money, as this technology advances, we get farther and farther behind on an exponential level, because we cannot keep up because the money is not there. So this money is put into a bank so that every few years we can take it out and get new equipment. And it's critical. It's not, for example, if we swept funds from ODFW, ODFW is an important agency, and it would be probably hurt some of their programs. But when we sweep money from 911, it puts us back, I'm probably wrong in saying this, but puts us back decades to technology. And that's why 911 deals with life and safety. Other agencies do also, but this is, when you're laying on that road dialing 911, you would hope that that money has been there to upgrade the equipment so they know exactly where you are, because it is your life on the line, and that's what this bill is about.
I appreciate that, and just one further follow-up. I remember we have cut our state police over and over again, and if we don't have our police, state police, there won't be anyone to use the 911 or respond to the 911. I mean, it's a very complex issue. I'm not saying that I'm in favor of sweeps. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that it's very, very complex.
Mr. Michael?
Chair Boquist, thank you. Senator Montes Anderson, if I may respond, the cost of running a PSAP, a point public safety answering point, is what it is. When the money is swept, that difference needs to be made up, and it's going to be made up by local cities and counties, cities who are preempted from many, many potential revenue sources and whose main revenue source, property taxes, are limited to a 3% assessment increase a year. Our expenses are far outweighing, the growth in expenses far outweighing the growth in income. So when the state sweeps that money, that 911 cost increases, it will be met, but then other units of government are forced to cut other necessary services that the state's not providing.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on 1560 and open a public hearing on 1561. 1561 relates to Homeland Security Council. While Council is coming back, I'll ask Mr. Cameron and General Caldwell to come up. I haven't seen. Yeah, they're both here. Okay. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1561 has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, no subsequent referral. It modifies Homeland Security Council structure and aligns it with H.J.R. 7 from 2011 if that measure is approved by voters.
Gentlemen.
Good morning, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, policy advisor with the Governor's Office for Military, Veterans, and Emergency Management. And I just want to comment briefly here this morning on previous practice on the Homeland Security Council and what our current practice is on the council. So previously, I think it came out of legislation in 2007 with its first meetings in 2008. And it's been kind of, as we figure out in the post 9/11 world, how do we handle and incorporate terrorism into our emergency management practices? So previously we had the Oregon model where we truly had every stakeholder represented on this council. And it was both such a broad mission for the council and such broad stakeholder engagement that it never really meshed up well or synced and was not a terribly effective group for the governor, for the legislature, for the agencies, or the stakeholders. So currently, the governor's only appointed those individuals specifically called out in the statute. So the governor is on the council, the adjutant general, superintendent of state police, and then the OEM director, and then four legislators. So this is a more tailored group that we think will be better used by both the governor, the legislature, the agencies, and the stakeholders. That's not to say that the local voice, particularly the law enforcement voices in terms of the sheriffs and the local police, are not important. Right now, the Fusion Center run by Oregon DOJ is largely that kind of joint cooperation on the law enforcement front to be able to advise policy officials at every level in terms of those joint operations. And lastly, just as a brief point, Homeland Security for me seems to be an umbrella term for security efforts that protect against terrorist activity. Where I think Oregon is more focused is on the all-hazards approach to emergency management, which includes terrorism, but also includes our natural disasters like earthquakes, floods, fires, and storms, and other catastrophes. What we do well as a state, you know, we really do well in terms of our cross-state agency coordination on emergency management, even looking at this recent round of January flooding that affected Marion and some of our southern valley counties as well as the coast. We really do well in terms of that coordination across state agencies in responding to emergencies. We do reasonably well in terms of intergovernmental relations, both up to FEMA Region 10 and also down to our cities and counties. One area that I think we've been weaker on is in terms of that cross-coordination between government, businesses, nonprofits, faith-based, and our citizens in terms of how do we truly create as much resilience as possible to all hazards in emergency management. The governor and the legislature have been very supportive of that. They've funded a public-private coordinator in OEM. That has been on hold, pending if there's going to be future budget cuts. We don't want to build up that program if it's going to be cut. But that all-hazards approach and truly getting that cross-coordination between all those groups is where we would like to put the center of effort and have this more tailored effort on Homeland Security with more of an executive approach. That's all I have.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. I'm going to repeat what he said. He summed it up very well, and I think we totally support the changes to make it a more efficient and more meaningful organization. So, include my testimony. Happy to answer any questions.
And just for the record, I mean, the changes take effect if the referral that went out takes effect, too. So, basically, we're just technical housekeeping and trying to streamline and make it more effective. Question?
Not for me.
Go ahead.
I don't have any.
I need to understand a little bit about this new government entity that we are forming here in the control of it. So I agree. So is the governor taken out of it? And so just explain a little bit, and maybe you've done it in previous, and I just don't remember previous committees.
Mr. Chair.
General Cole, just let me make a clarification. The Homeland Security Council exists now, and I'm on it. I'm one of the Senate appointees, and I believe Senator Verger is the other, is the my counterpart in the House. And it has an executive committee at the top, and it's basically just streamlining the existing organization. And then I'll let kind of General Caldwell go for there. And it was actually the 2005 session when it was created. Senator Verger and I were co-chairs, and then it's been around since then. The good news is you don't know much about it because I get the weekly report, and I'm the one that gets to disseminate it to all the state senators when there's something going on in their district, and nothing's gone wrong in your district. So you haven't got any reports. Go ahead, General Caldwell.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Monis Anderson, exactly. This is an existing institution. It has been for 7-8 years. It's not been real effective because we had a lot of difficulty in pulling in all the stakeholders. We had a tremendous number of folks on this group. I forget the number, but I think I'm going to say 16, 17, something like that.
Well, there were meetings with 100 people on it. So.
Yeah, indeed. And our intention isn't to just limit it to this dark room with locks on the door. Our intention is to have this group actually look for the subcommittees to bring these other groups in to assist, but not make it a mandatory, got to meet it, you got to have a name in a slot, which was cumbersome. And again, they just didn't show up. They came to the first meeting, maybe the third meeting, and that was about it. Then pretty soon you were down to five or six or seven, mainly legislators and law enforcement people. So it's kind of trying to pattern this off of what's really happening, as opposed to having this faux group that really doesn't participate and doesn't interact. And then as we need those kind of groups, we need that kind of interplay, invite them in, have them part of this process. That's really what the intention is.
And I'd follow up that if you look at the staff summary and you recall, House Joint Resolution 7 is the continuation of government in the unlikely event of a catastrophic emergency. And so that's what kind of led to the changes on the Homeland Security Council of, to make sure a quick flow of information is going to, if you recall, we talked about this last session, the surviving members of the legislature, that we're able to push information quickly through to the presiding officer so we know what's going on. And so even this bill only takes effect if House Joint Resolution 7 goes forward. So,
yeah, I don't see much opposition to House Joint Resolution 4?
7.
Yeah. Or is there? I don't know. But you just see when I look at the representatives, the governor, the adjutant general, the superintendent of state police, then the director of the Office of Emergency Management, those are good. I just don't know enough about the mission of the group where cities or counties aren't at the table, because that's where the action actually occurs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bono Sanderson, I think as Cameron explained, when this was created, the Fusion Center was kind of a notional aspect. Where information comes in from both top and the bottom, from the street police, sheriff's deputies, FBI, it all comes to one center. That was notional at the time. We didn't really have that in this state. It was just starting to form. It's become, I think, nationwide. In fact, as I just left a meeting in D.C. last week, that the Fusion Centers, of all the funding that Department of Homeland Security, they're cutting back, as we all know. The thing they're not cutting back on are Fusion Centers. They believe in these as the...
Now, Fusion Center...
A Fusion Center is basically a place where law enforcement officials, Attorney General's office, people who enforce the law and prosecute it, they're all in one spot, basically. And so if information is coming from the feds, let's say from the FBI or the Homeland Security or whomever it may come from, it will be flowed down to this one center where you have local government representatives, you have state government representatives, you have Attorney General representatives, and then they analyze this information based on the analyzation that they've gotten from above or below, and then they disseminate it out to the locals and or to the feds, depending on which direction it needs to go, and many times all of the above. And so we're trying to prevent the situation that happened in 911, where one group wasn't talking to another group simply because they did this work on the border and these folks did something else. And this is the idea behind it, is to have all these representatives in one spot so everybody's getting a look at the same information, because it may not mean something to one organization, it may mean something huge to another, and then they crosstalk instead of silos. That was in its infant stages when this group was created. I think it's done exceedingly well in this state. I think there's been some great successes, and it would be, in fact, as the last time we had our Homeland Security meeting, we did have the Fusion Center come in and brief us, and I thought it was very insightful to see what was going on in this law enforcement arena, because that's typically where we're going to see most activity anyway. That's where we're going to get the canary in the mine. That's what we're going to see first. And I think that was really helpful for us to understand that General Reese is the governor's Homeland Security advisor, is the adjutant general, has a direct link with that organization. So, for instance, there was a incident, there was a, was a Christmas bombing, I guess it was, the Christmas tree bombing attempt up in Portland. That key group, along with the state police, the governor, attorney general, all those folks got informed basically at the same time what was going to happen in the next 30, 40 minutes. We didn't know anything beforehand because we didn't have a need to know. But before they executed the arrest and everything on that individual, they were notified. And that's what this is all designed to do. Now, I suspect that if you look back at that case, it may have come from the Corvallis Police Department where it started. Who knows? But the Fusion Center helped put all the pieces together to prevent that tragedy from happening.
So that's different than...
It's different than this group. Yes, indeed.
Okay. And so like this, the Occupy...
Occupy,
If it gets out of hand, would the local, the Fusion Center...
Yes, they're talking.
Fusion
Center, Portland Police Bureau, State Police, they're always in communication. The federal attorney's in there. You've got all the right players in there, and they're running this information back and forth off of each other. Again, that wasn't very well developed when we created this Homeland Security Council, and we realize now that it's too large, it's ineffective, it doesn't work. We need to get it smaller. We need to get it so we can react quicker and we can get the information to the right people at the appropriate time, as opposed to trying to pull all this huge group together.
And I would say, committee members, twice we have scheduled to actually go visit it as the committee. But unfortunately, other conflicts, you know, in our schedule in the Senate have cut the meeting short or moved the meetings or something. And sometime, hopefully after, obviously not in the February session because it's a little fast around here right now, but after that, we will reschedule. And when there's not legislative days and not confirmations going on, and we'll attempt maybe the third time's a charm to actually go over there and go through the center. It's basically an operation center. And you walk through it and you can get a full brief and then you can kind of understand the interface because it goes all the way down to the city and all the way to Washington, D.C. You have city representatives, county representatives, you've got fire, you have all county police, immediate other types of response, even NGO type actions that are in there.
So. And this group will not do that day-to-day function. That's being handled. But this group may say, listen, you know, we're getting political pushback from Juntura, Oregon, that they're not getting taken care of or something. And this is where the more the political aspects of it can be infused into the operations end of things. So we have the connection between the, you know, the people who, you as the representative of the people, and this group, which is actually the functionary. So that's the kind of the idea behind this whole thing. So we don't have people working separate purposes.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you much, gentlemen. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on 1561 and open a public hearing on 1563. Councilor?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1563 extends certain state law protections and benefits already available to military service personnel, to members of the Commission Corps of the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration. There is an emergency effective on passage. An amendment was requested and processed almost immediately after the informational hearing on January 19th that provides for the same extension of benefits to the Commission Corps of the United States Public Health Service. There is no revenue impact on the dash one or the introduced measure, but we haven't got a fiscal back on either. There's no subsequent referral. No one has signed up, Mr. Chair, to testify, but if you'll recall on the 19th...
I'll cover that. Colleagues, if you do recall on the 19th that this bill came to our committee from Senator Verger and Representative Cowan, we've made like five attempts to clean up the definition of veterans and match it with the federal statute. We found out during the interim, I guess as NOAA established a large foothold in Coos Bay, that NOAA was part of the federal veterans definition and when they weren't not in state law. And then it was also raised in the informational time we had during the January session we were here, in which the Public Health Service uniformed officers aren't in the definition at the state, but they're in the definition at the federal level. And so this is probably the fifth cleanup attempt at the definition of veterans we've done since 2005. And there is a dash one amendment that adds the Public Health Service into it. And what it really does is simply align this aligns it closer. I'm not going to say it aligns it with, because this is like the fifth time we've attempted to do this. It aligns it closer to the federal definition of veterans so that when it comes to benefits and service officers working with everybody, that everybody's on the same sheet of music. And I know that Senator Ferger and Senator Cowan had other engagements. So if there are any questions? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on 1563, and I am going to open a public or a work session on 1563 to put this amendment in so that the legislative fiscal office can get the right fiscal if the bill goes forward. Madam Vice Chair?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash ones to Senate Bill 1563 dated 1-26-12.
Senator Montes Anderson moves to adopt the dash one amendment stated 01-26-12. Is there any discussion? Senator Courtney?
I do.
Senator Olson?
No.
Madam Vice Chair? Seeing no discussion, is there any objection? If there's no objection, the amendment is adopted. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on 1563. Other business of the committee till next week?
Could I?
Senator Courtney,
if I want to speak on the Senate Bill 1560-911, do you want to go back and open a public hearing, or just should I make a general statement?
I think a general statement's fine, unless you want it in the record with the public.
Well, I just want to say something. I was taken by the discourse between Senator Alan Olson and Senator Lori Moss Anderson, and at the time I had texted my chief of staff. I said, did we sweep 911 in terms of the co-chair's budget that just has come out? And he's reported about to be, we did not sweep for this rebalance. Later today at 4:30, I will learn what the economic forecast is, and tomorrow at 8 o'clock, the world will learn what the forecast is. And I just want to say that I have been involved, in my 28 years here, I have been involved in sweeping just about everything imaginable. Cultural trust, safe, 911, it goes on and on. And I've watched men and women, Democrats and Republicans, rural, urban, veterans, and not veterans, almost with their tears in their eyes sometimes, do the sweeps. And I'm not going to try to create the scenario I can't, the kind of crisis you find yourselves in when you're desperately trying to figure out a way to deal with the services of Oregonians and you're trying to make judgment calls. I want to make it very clear to you that I'm particularly sensitive to this issue. I've watched Senator Alan Olson kill himself to try to get the parties together on 9/11, and I'm always amazed when I think of, like, when I used to practice law, you have a terrible fight going on between a husband and a wife as they separate, but they all want to know what's in the best interest of the children. And somewhere, if you listen to them, the best interest of children goes right out the window. In health care, this big fight about health care costs, I haven't heard the word patient ever in there, which is the bottom line. And then here I am hearing about 9/11 and sweeps and going on and how horrible we are we'd even consider it. And I think Senator Olson said, because in the end, when someone is in a desperate life situation, but I find it interesting, we brought before us, and Senator Olson's killed himself in a way of lobbyists in their groups. And somehow, I listen to this and I smile and find myself saying, where is that everyday person supposedly they're so concerned about on 9/11? And all I'm going to say is that I want you, the members of this committee, to understand something. I've never seen a sweep take place in this building that was easy or was done because they wanted to do it. It was horrible. Horrible. I mean, I've watched grown men cry, break down and cry to do certain things. And I think the dialogue is beautiful to listen to Senator Lori Moss and Senator Olson, because Senator Olson visualized for your out and out highway, your guts are laid out, you got to have help. And then Senator Lori Moss Anderson says, state police, we can't even use gas tests to take a state police. And so just those kinds of struggles. So I just want to make sure everybody understands that these sweeps are not done willy-nilly. They're not done with sensitivity. We're under siege right now in the crime victim situation, as you may or may not know, because there is some sweeping going on in these budgets. But for purposes of where we are right now, the co-chairs who killed themselves to find a way to get together, co-chair Dennis Richardson, co-chair Peter Buckley, and co-chair Richard Devlin, to get there, they did not sweep 9/11. But I just really want to say that I just can't sit here because some of the statements, I won't say they offended me, but they got me a little tense, but I've been wanting to make sure I didn't shoot my mouth off, and unfortunately the information about this rebalance didn't come until the gavel went down. So I love this committee, you know that, and I wanted to be here, and I respect you all so much. But I wanted that just to say that regarding a sweep of 9/11. I have never seen it done, and I've been involved in sweeping the 9/11. It was brutal. It was horrible. We didn't want to do it, but we were talking about some others. So I just thank you for letting me say that. And and I'm going to get in trouble. I know these forecasts, we're within hours of getting the forecast, and hopefully they're not going to put us in a situation where we have to go back. But I've watched groups say, well, you can sweep everything, but not this, because this is so important. When we swept cultural trust once, you might get it. Interesting. We swept the cultural trust once, and they burned all our houses down, and it was beyond description. I just sat there dumbfounded. Now, I'm not saying culture is not important. I know you love culture, and you all are big culture. And, I'm culturally deprived. But I've watched sweeps, and I've watched people literally jumping out windows, because we could dare do that. But as an Oregonian, as a veteran legislator, I have never seen a sweep done willy-nilly or cutesy or vindictively, and I want that in the record. And so thank you for letting me say that, and I would have said it earlier, but I wanted to be sure I knew what I was talking about regarding this budget, or I looked like a real idiot. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Corrigan, we appreciate the comments, too. We really do. Any other comments to the committee before we close the meeting? I would point out that at this point, SB 1561 and SB 1563 remain on the work plan for next week, and then we'll be looking at today the future of 1559 and 1560. I would remind members that we have been advised that there's about 5 House bills that are coming over, which the third week, maybe we'll see them next week, but I doubt it, will be in the third week coming over. There were 5, and I was told earlier this morning there's now 4. And it might even only be 3. I couldn't quite understand the note, and I didn't have my texting machine to text over there and say, do you mean both of those are dead and there's only 3 coming this direction now instead of that? So I would actually expect a fairly light and short meeting next week. With that, the meeting of the Veterans and Military Affairs is closed for the day.